So, we're all here.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So, how is everybody doing?
Ready to hear about good karma.
Ready to hear about good karma. Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, ready for the purification? Okay, well, first of all, let me do a little purification here. Let me apologize to Wall if I was flip about that comment about the Ten Commandments and they're being superficial. I really wasn't referring to Christianity in any way. I was really thinking of the Ten Commandments in their prehistoric, you know, Hammurabi Code, Hittite Empire, archaic manifestation, which is very much a kind of a punishment reward system. And you know, the first several of those commandments are all about establishing a monotheism and getting rid of the polytheism. And I mean that was a very Iron Age legalistic system, that the Ten Commandments in and of themselves, and you know, six of the ten had the death penalty attached to them. It's, you know, I know Christians, the entire Judeo-Christian tradition now does not aspire to that kind of practice. So I'm thinking more of that kind of, the kind of ethics we learned as kids, you know, where things were very, you know, black and white, and you operated on a punishment reward system. And that's what I meant by simplistic, where there were good people and bad people, and the bad people should be punished, and there's the us, the good ones, and the them, the bad ones. Now, obviously, Christianity, as soon as you get to the New Testament, that's a whole new ethics. I mean, it's true they start off with a Ten Commandment kind of basis, but then the New Testament adds that quite extraordinary flourish that one must, the most important commandment is to love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, there you go. That's, you know, you're undermining the whole us and them category. You're establishing the, you know, the higher importance of one's mental state, one's attitude. We're talking about loving one's neighbor as oneself, equalizing self and others. I mean, in very many ways, it's similar, frankly, to Buddhist ethics. And as far as Buddhist ethics goes, and Christian ethics, there's not so much difference. I mean, there is a difference in terms of animals. Animals are just here for the use of human beings, at least in the old-style Christian ethics. Now, even that's changing very rapidly, and some of the people I admire most, their ethical practice, actually, are the Catholic nuns, you know, the ones that are being, you know, investigated by the Vatican, or at least were until we have this grand new pope who is very interesting, and who's added his masala to the whole ethical mix, hasn't he? Right away he said, let's stop talking about sex, and let's talk about maybe things that are more important. So, Christian ethics evolving too, and we'll see. This pope, I just can hardly wait to see the Dalai Lama meet Pope Francis. This will be a wonderful moment. And, you know, I'm a recovering Catholic. You know, once you're a Catholic, you know, you're... I'm an ethnic Irish Catholic, what can I say? So those things, you know, they still pull at my heartstrings. It gave me goosebumps to read those comments from Pope Francis. I just thought, wow, this is going to make a lot of Catholics really happy who have been kind of embarrassed by the fundamentalist trend and the kind of the oppressive, oppressive trends of in the more recent unless I get on shaky ground again and far back. If I go back in history also, there's a little problem there. But yes, and Venerable Domodino and I were just, a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at the website of a group of Catholic nuns who have turned their monastery in Ireland into an eco-monastery. And they are running, like, seminars and workshops to get other parishes worldwide on board to teach ecological responsibility. Now, of course, this is completely, this is revolutionary, and, you know, to solve the problems of the world, to turn around the ecological destruction of the world, we're going to need everybody. You know, we're going to need everybody, all hands on deck, to solve this problem. No one group is going to be able to do it. No one country is going to be able to do it. Everybody's going to have to realign their values and work together. So that's an incredible thing, that if both the Buddhists and the Catholics and the Protestants and all of us all get together and concentrate perhaps on more important ethical values than have been in the past, such as conformity. Yeah, so but that was a flip comment to make. So I do apologize, and you know, we're both students of Hisayunsa Dalai Lama, and one of his most important, you know, he says he has three objectives. One of his most important objectives is to work for interfaith progress and interfaith relations in on the world, and he does all the time. It's usually the first topic he talks about in a public talk. And interestingly, I will tell you a little story. when I was in Dharamsala and I took an ordination, took my ordination with the Dalai Lama, and I got to, you know, go into the His Holiness's private chapel in the his headquarters there in Dharamsala. You know, I was at the long end of a long line of Tibetan, young Tibetan monks, maybe like 100 or so, and then there's like 4 or 5 of us Westerners. The woman right in front of me was from Korea, and I was like maybe the last or the second to last in seniority. And anyway, we go in and we all sit down in his meditation hall there, and he speaks to each group. And so he spoke to the Tibetans who were coming, who had come across the mountains, who had walked across the Himalayas for their ordination. He spoke to them first. Then he spoke to the local Tibetans who were ordaining. And then he spoke to the South Korean. And then he spoke to us Westerners. And you know what he said to us Westerners? Here we are, we're sitting there, you know, we've got shaved heads and we're wearing robes for the first day in our lives. And we're obviously, you know, committed Buddhists, you know. And he says, you know, it's probably better that you all stay with your religion of origin. And I think, oh darn, I'm in the wrong place. And he says, it's probably better for people to stay with their religion of origin. They have, you know, you learn things when you're young that are very, they impact you deeply. And, you know, you have your cultural associations and, you know, your community. And the last thing that we want is a lot of, like, fundamentalist Buddhists, Western fundamentalist Buddhist converts running around talking about how Buddhism is the one true religion. So anyway, this is very important, and you know, he's addressing each group with what he is concerned about. So of course he's concerned with the importance of us each as ambassadors, as representatives of him, actually, in the world. And he wants, if we're going to represent him, he wants us to reflect an absolute respect for other faiths. Anyway, I don't think anybody practices the Ten Commandments in the prehistoric first millennium BC manner anymore. So I still do feel safe with saying that's probably more simplistic than what we're talking about here. Anybody any comments on that topic?
You have certainly studied a lot of things in depth. I would not have known. Oh, that's the Hittites from
I like history. I'm very interested in history. History helps, it undermines your sense of simplicity. That's right. It gives you a sense of the complexity of what we're experiencing right now in the world and the huge array of causes and conditions and how difficult it is to say us and them. Because if you go back a little, just not so far back, them is us.
We were them.
And the cycle of injustice that has been twirling around in samsara over many, many, many millennium, probably since, surely as soon as we settled down and started being agrarian. Maybe as hunter-gatherers we were so spread out. But even then, probably territory has always been an issue, and one people is here and another people wants what they have, and there's anyway, so it's important not to be too sure that you're right about anything in history, frankly, because you're probably not. History is a very conceptual overlay. You can only say the most broad, simplistic things about history, but actually what happens is individuals, people's, lives and their struggle to be good people. They're all struggling to be good people, generation after generation, millennium after millennium. One thing I'm sure of about history is that virtually everybody throughout history was trying hard to be a good person, and that their mistaken actions flow from their ignorance, from their this thing called a idea of a self, ideas of good people and bad people. And basically ignorance. But it wasn't for want of wishing to be a hero of their own lives, but tremendous, as we all know, tremendous opportunities to make grave mistakes and then defend them terribly. Okay, so
these lines a little bit. And I forget who it was who said that. It might have been Venerable, about how Buddhism wasn't really meant to be like a socially organizing type of function. And then I was thinking, well, it has so much social impact if we're talking about killing and stealing,
right,
sexual conduct, and it like has this huge effect on it.
Yeah.
Function
the individual, sure, it definitely does, and some countries have organized themselves entirely around Buddhism. But in the beginning, it wasn't meant to be a political movement or to inform government. For one thing, from the very beginning, the Buddha didn't want his monks to compete on the governmental political stage. And there was already a religious tradition in place. Could we correctly call it the Hindu tradition? Maybe not quite yet. The Vedic tradition. Please?
Brahmanical.
The Brahmanical, call it the Brahmanical tradition, was already in place. So the Buddha put in place some safeguards so that his monks wouldn't get carried away about empire building. And for instance, the Buddha didn't want his monks to perform like wedding ceremonies, funerals, those kinds of things, because that was the province of the Brahmin caste. So he didn't. So he didn't want to step on those toes. Yeah. So in the same way, the last thing that the Buddha would have wanted was to get too involved as a spiritual practice, as a personal spiritual practice. Having said that, though, of course, then you have King Ashoka, who on the battlefield has an insight about the horror of war and what he's done, and becomes the great Buddhist emperor. Anyway, we could go on and on.
History's long and involved.
But it's also true that as we have responsibility now, perhaps in the world, it might be a little different. And the important thing, I'll just say one more thing about politics and social change and social justice. The safeguard for us as Buddhists in terms of our involvement in those kinds of activities is emptiness. Is emptiness. We have to understand, we have to have a little realization of the emptiness of our own position, the emptiness of the others who are on the other side, so to speak. Meaning that they don't have some kind of fixed nature that makes them the opponent. Yeah. Anyway, this is also a long topic, but just let me say, it's important to not reify one's own identity around the action. Yeah. Because that creates that judgmentalism, and it creates the us and them thing. It creates anger. It creates the idea that I'm right and you are miserably deluded and I will fix you. And of course, that's not very effective, because you can't tell people, you know, you're miserably deluded and wrong and destroying the world, and they're not going to go, oh, I'm so sorry. I'll fix that right now. That is very unskillful. You know, you have to get people on your side. And if you watch His Holiness, he is such a model of skillful working with the difficult person. Yeah? It's amazing to watch him. You could just... it's amazing to listen to him and see his skillfulness in working with difficult issues. and even at lunch today, we were talking about the problem of anger the anger that arose in the Occupy movement, for instance. It wrecked the Occupy movement. It destroyed it. The hatred and the anger and the kill the rich. Well, most people aren't going to get on board for that. And, you know, even people like me, you know, I thought, let's support Occupy. And then I started reading. I said, no way, we're not putting our Dharma Center's name on that petition. These people are, they've given a platform for people that are spewing hatred. Yeah, so... it's slow. His Holiness likes to say that compassionate action is a little bit slower, and it's not so you know, it doesn't gratify the anger and the adrenaline and the wish to fix it. You know, it requires more patience and it's slower. And he himself, you know, he has a multi-generational view himself in terms of his own big issue, which is Tibet. Rather than force, you know, he's always the young Tibetans in Tibet. He's always trying to keep a lid on their wish, their impatience, and their wish to be to engage in violence, which would just it would be the end. They would just be trampled. But people are they're impatient, and there's something, you know, energizing and relieving to act, forcefully. Yeah. Anyway, it's a very big topic. But yes, as individuals, we want to work on our own stuff first, our anger, attachment, and sense of a reified self. And having that, having made some progress there, or at least having a lot of self-awareness about our own emotional delusions, yeah. Then with lots of humility and patience, then we want to do what we can to be of benefit. I mean, this is the Mahayana view at any rate, and I think it's true across Buddhist groups, certainly here in America. I think, you know, at least in my experience, the people that come to Dharma class have a lot of karma for that engaged practice and the wish to be of benefit. Lots of karma for that. In fact, we have to start out with that because you can't even go into, working with your own suffering before you've assured them that we're going to get to everybody else's soon. Yeah. So, okay, let's get back on topic here, which was what? Oh, okay, one thing, something I want to say about our, and Venerable's talking about this a little bit. The thing to remember about the precepts and the 10 negative actions and the harmful actions is that Buddhist ethics is presented to us as a training. And in terms of practicing it, it is a training. Okay, so this is in this way it differs, say, from like the 10 commandments approach, where there is a set of given rules and one, if one fails, one is punished, and one and succeeds, one is rewarded. Yeah. Instead, the very practice of engaging with the world, in with all of your warts and your mistakes as you move through the world trying to live a beneficial life, the process is one of making mistakes and getting realistic feedback from those mistakes, and learning, basically, and learning for your own sake. Oh, that's a simple way of putting it. Yeah, so by way of through regret, yeah, through, by making a mistake and generating, making contact with your wisdom, your understanding of what is safe. That's one way of talking about wisdom. What is safe? Oh, I've got a good analogy for that. I'll come back to it in a minute. Contacting your understanding of your own values of personal integrity, and then realizing that you've made a mistake and you have a regret. Or maybe you wouldn't even call it a mistake, but it's just something that you're unable to do differently at this time. But there's a process of engaging with that flaw and that mistake in which by way of the regret, by way of engaging your wisdom, your training, you see, your training in your own evolution. You are, from the Buddhist point of view, you are the master of your own ethical evolution. You're your own, you will forgive yourself. There's nobody else that's going to forgive you. You forgive yourself. But you have to do what's necessary to accomplish that. Yeah? So that, so what's safe? So, you know, when we were talking about the characteristics of an akusala, or akusala, a akusala, a thing which is kusala, and a mind which is kusala, I just realized how hard that must be to hear. You can't tell until you hear the rest of the sentence what we're talking about, can you? A thing which, a mind that is kusala, we said it had four characteristics, right? We said it was healthy, not turbulent, disturbed. What were the other ones?
Content.
It was content, productive of well-being and contentment. Very good, yes. It was associated with contentment, well-being, satisfaction, peacefulness, clarity, it's not obscured, cloudy, confused,
wisdom,
yes. It is in harmony with wisdom. These are important because we're talking about a mind or a state that is kusala. And remember, we were talking about what is the nature of happiness. Yeah, and kusala actions are productive of happiness. Yes? And we said there's a little difference between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure is more of a very short-term, immediate gratification. Not very interested in the long term, and often in contradiction to long term happiness. So this happiness that we're talking about, your practice of ethics is conducive in the most immediate level of happiness, which has these characteristics. And so you want to know, well, what kind of happiness is this? It's a happiness that is, it's a mind that is healthy, not disturbed, not distraught. It's a mind that is clear and not confused. It's a mind that's wise and that understands what is safe and what is not safe, what's harmful and what's not harmful, among other kinds of wisdom. And it's a mind that is content, feeling satisfied, feeling relaxed, at ease. So this wisdom that is, you know, that lets us, from which we know, we understand what is safe. And Venerable was talking earlier about, you know, this idea of restraint and how, you know, we're not going to fill the kingdom with people that want to come and study what restraint is. Certainly, you know, in our 20-somethings in Seattle, if we say we're going to do a class on restraint and wholesome and unwholesome deeds, whoa, it will be an empty room. But restraint, you know, if you thought, yeah, I was thinking, you know, it's like, you all know I was a wilderness guide for almost 25 years, and, you know, during that time, you know, I was out in the ocean, and a lot is happening out there, and there's scary things out there, and conditions are changing, and you've got, you know, weather changing, and then, of course, you know, if you've got a group out there, it even ups the ante. And, or you're moving through the desert, and it's an alien environment to you, or to your people in your group. And so, you know, they don't know what's safe and what's not. So there's two parts. First of all, people, you have to know what's safe, what's dangerous, and what's not. And then you have to be mindful. So, you know, so when we sit people down in an orientation, they go down to Baja and they've never been in the desert, you know, a day in their lives. The mindfulness aspect is you have to watch all the time with every step where you put your feet and where you put your hands. And if you just go blundering through the desert, you blunder, you know, over a moving rock, or you blunder into a rattlesnake, or you blunder into a cactus, you put your hand, you're moving on a cliff, you put your hand on, you know, you can't put your hand somewhere where you can't see it. There's stuff. So it's, and likewise in the ocean, you've got to pay attention. You know, people who have the idea of navigation, you know, it's like something, you get out the map and you're just like la-di-da and not paying attention, and then you get out your little compass and your map and then suddenly you can figure out where you are. No, it's not like that. You're all the time knowing where you are. All the time. You're looking at that point and you're looking at that cove. You're looking at your map. Oh, yes, that's there and that's there. And I know what's around this point here and I know what comes next. So there's a process in which you become less anxious and nervous out there, because, you know, when you're first there, it's like everything is scary and you don't know what's dangerous and what's not, so everything is intense. Yeah. But gradually, as you learn what the things are that really need to be careful of, you become less nervous, less afraid, but more alert. And that mindfulness, you know that your mindfulness will take care of you. Yeah? If you pay attention, you know what's going on around you. You know where you put your hands, you put your feet. Well, nothing's going to like jump out and get you if you're paying attention. And it's like that with our practice too. If we know what's to be avoided and what's to be practiced. You know, that classic line about what the most important things to know. What is to be avoided and what's to be practiced. What actions are harmful? What are the causes of suffering? Yeah. So if we feel, that gives us a confidence. If we know what we want to avoid. And then mindfulness is the next part, so that we're not just blundering along saying things we wish we hadn't said afterwards. Yeah. So this wisdom, you know, it helps us. That's the wisdom and the mindfulness. It's the way to move through life and not be anxious and to feel good in your own skin, to feel confident of your choices, to know that you're doing your best. You've got some good guidance. Mistakes happen. The mistakes, not only do we learn from the mistakes, but they sure increase our compassion for others, as I said before. So the whole process of your ethical practice is a training in the same way that you would train to move through a wilderness environment. Okay. Same way the five precepts. I don't know if you take the five precepts or some of the precepts. I don't know if you take refuge. Usually you take one precept. Does this ring a bell, you all?
Take the five precepts.
Take one precept. What's that?
I don't know. Can you ever just take one precept?
Yeah, you can. But you all take five. Okay, so the precepts are training. In the same way, the precepts are training. You don't take them because you can do them all perfectly. If you could do them all perfectly, then you wouldn't actually need to take them. Yeah, you take them as a support for your training in your ethical discipline. Yeah, so, yeah, they're a training. So, I'm just, because you have to wait another 24 hours before we get to the purification. I want to tell you, even the mistakes have a wholesome aspect if you bring your dharma to them. Because they are your training. Okay, so this restraint, in the same way that you wouldn't go blundering through the desert and not paying any attention to what you're doing, all of the precepts, or rather all of the 10 negative actions, they have a restraint aspect. You know, we're refraining from the 10, we're refraining from doing harm, refraining from those 3 actions of body, 4 of speech, 3 of mind. And Venerable Tomorrow is going to finish the rest of them. But so, as well as that refraining aspect to each one, there is a benefit. So there is a positive action that corresponds to each of these 10. So you can talk about the 10 negative actions, and you can talk about the 10 positive actions. And here at the beginning, also I'll say that just like the 10 negative actions are, they're a list, and they are, they're representative, but it's not a comprehensive list of everything that's harmful. Yeah. In the same way, the list of the 10 positive actions, there are positive actions that aren't included in the 10. For instance, you know, we don't need to do that right now. So, for instance, if we talk about the three of the body. So there's the negative action of killing. There's the positive action of protecting life. In all of the forms that you could think of, protecting life, protecting beings from harm, from physical harm. So if you're a nurse and you go to work all day, as a nurse, you can think all day long doing positive actions, creating positive karma. And then, of course, and then you set your motivation to make it a dharma, to make it very deliberate, because we want to live deliberately in a positive way, and then you dedicate. So on your way to work, you set your motivation. On the way home from work, you dedicate. I mean, this goes for every kind of, not just protecting life, but whatever you're doing at work is benefiting beings. That's why they want to pay you. They're going to pay you to benefit them. That's part of our economy of benefit in the world. Yeah. So whatever you're doing at work, there's people that are being benefited by it. So on the way to work, you don't have to be a nurse. On the way to work, you set your motivation that you want to benefit the people that you will work with today. And that's your reason for going to work. That makes your whole work a dharma practice. Whatever it is, I don't care if it's standing behind a cash register in the grocery store. I want to make these beings happy. That's why I'm doing my work. Help them get the things that they want to fulfill their basic needs. Treat them respectfully. Smile at them. And a lot of people, it's one of their most intimate moments of the day for some people is their moment with the person that checks them out at the cash register. Maybe like the old bartender used to be. You would go in and sit on the bar stool and tell your complaints and problems to the bartender. Now we go through the checkout line. They say, did you find everything you want? No, I couldn't find that such and such. Oh, wow, I think maybe they might have that. You know, they ran out of that. Or sometimes they'll get somebody to come and get it for you or tell you how you can solve your problem. And then dedicate at the end of the day. It makes your work a Dharma practice and full of creation of positive karma. And even if it's not going to work, I mean, whatever your day is, you start set your motivation in the morning, and maybe you volunteer.
Oh.
Maybe you just housekeep. Yeah, you set your motivation. For all of your contact with your neighbors, may I be a blessing on my block to the people that I run into today, with the errands that I run. May my presence make people happy as I move through my day. So, protecting life. And then, you know, just let me say one other thing on that topic before I get back to my 10 positive. Venerable Dhammadina and I were talking today, and probably she's going to teach you this, so here I am taking her stuff. She told me this, mentioned this great thing to me today. to remind that we should remember that to engage in our ethical practice with the idea, with the knowledge that we're engaging in our ethical practice is much more powerful than just to, just to avoid the negative actions kind of accidentally. You know, it's much more powerful to do it as a practice. I'm aware that I'm avoiding this negative action. I'm aware that I'm generating this, that I'm doing this positive thing. Yeah. So it's more powerful. It has a stronger influence on our mind stream, you see, because once again, it's a training. So the things that have the deepest impact on our psyche, the way that we do the thing that it would have the deepest impact on our psyche, that's what we're interested in, because we're training, we're cultivating, we're evolving, we're learning, we're developing. So it's stronger, it's more powerful if we know I'm not going to say that because I am committed to my ethical practice. That's stronger than just kind of naturally not saying it, actually. Yeah? Does that make sense?
Is that just because you brought your
intention
forward in a way?
That's
like
right.
You really just owned it?
That's right. It's got more intentionality. You know, you brought it, it's a bigger deal for you.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not just an accidental niceness, for instance. And so the Dharma practice is very efficient that way, because it makes what we do then, our positive actions, very powerful and very transformative. And that can be as simple as all of the refraining. All of our, we already have habits of refraining. It's okay to notice and acknowledge that, oh yeah, already I'm committed to not gossiping, for instance. And to note. Has a bigger effect on the mind. Okay, so the first then, to protect the lives of others. The second, we said instead of, so the second negativity was to take what's not given, stealing basically, and taking what's not given in all of its forms. The positive correlate to that is to generously give what one can. To give instead of to take. That's simple enough. Giving, of course, it's got so much, the whole practice of giving is, it's the engaged practice of loving kindness, isn't it? Because to give is to wish that the other be happy, and it's to enact that, to give with the intention to make the other happy.
This,
and then of course the practice of giving also has this aspect of what it does for the giver, which is to antidote that natural tendency that we have to cling to nice things, and that clinging is such a painful state. It's such a source of our suffering that clinging, that wanting to keep. To antidote that by, to offset that by developing a practice of giving nice things is not just to make the other happy, but it's to make oneself happy as well, because one gets one training, again, we're training in the happiness of giving instead of the pleasure and what we think is happiness of keeping. I'm getting and keeping. So then to mindfully give and to note it as a practice, then of course that makes it more conscious, and then we get the training benefit and we get the feedback. We're more aware of the feedback of how pleasurable it is and how fun and beautiful and joyful it is to give. So as a practice and a training, we're learning the realistic results of giving. And if we just engage in clinging, keeping, we never get the benefit of knowing, of finding out what a deeper kind of pleasure and happiness that is. Okay, and then the third, the antidote, the opposite or the correlate to sexual misconduct, we could say, actually I used to say it was to cultivate trust and honesty in our relationships by respecting others' feelings, and that's true. It is. But I think more so, and also to actively support people in their relationships, because... this just came to me today as I was thinking about this, and I've been teaching it because I was taught it this other way for so very long, and I don't know why it wasn't ever, this has never been, that I haven't heard this mentioned, but And maybe it's because Buddhism isn't so oriented to relationships. Probably. That's why. But we know in our communities that socially, if people have a support for their relationship, if their friends and their family and their neighbors, their coworkers support that relationship, it's much more likely to be successful than if, for example, you've got a friend who is, you know, mumbling about your partner or, mm-hmm. or even just nothing, yeah. But if you have a relationship, you know how nice it is when somebody says, "Oh, isn't your partner your partner's wonderful? He's so da 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 da. You guys make a great couple. You're so nice together. We enjoy being with the two of you." That kind of thing. That's a huge support for people's relationships. So I think that might be. I don't know. What do you think of that? Yes, yes. Yes, that's great.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the appropriate corollary for this, for sexual misconduct.
We teach children that it means, because it has to do with sensual pleasure, so children are not sexually active, but they have mm-hmm. voice. Mm-hmm. So we teach children not to break other people's toys and don't steal their toys.
Uh-huh.
Play with your toys.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay. Okay. And so then the next four, which we haven't, Venable's going to talk about, as I said, speech tomorrow. So I'm just going to quickly go over the four. So the four types of wrong speech, lying, misleading, slandering others, talking about bad qualities of others, saying negative things about others, harsh words, and then finally gossip. Yeah. So the corollary, obviously, for lying is to speak the truth, to be honest to people, to others. I mean, you can avoid lying by just keeping your mouth shut, yeah, which sometimes is hard enough. Yeah, that's good. That's the entry level accomplishment. but to be honest, be open and honest in a skillful way. Obviously, if you go home for Thanksgiving and Grandma makes a cake and she puts too much salt in it and it's like unedible, and she says, "How's the cake, dear?" You can say, "Oh, I can just tell how much love you made this cake with." There's ways to avoid hurting people's feelings by, aggressive truth-telling. But on the other hand, nobody really wants to be lied to about the cake either, frankly. Because then they can't tell when you're telling the truth, when you're praising their cake. Yeah. Anyway, Venerable will probably talk about lying more. Okay, so then this next one, slandering. This has the corollary of speaking about others' good qualities. And talking about people in such a way that it unites them. Yeah, you know how easy it is to make people like each other. It's incredibly easy, actually. You can you say so and so thinks that you. It's true. You can repeat things. So and so thinks you have really beautiful voice. It takes very little to inject an element of liking between people. Yeah? And we know that because we do the opposite so much. And this is I just think this is a terribly, this is a really important precept. It's a really important precept in communities, because communities, if people talk badly about others in the group, it wrecks communities. It will wreck a Dharma group, for instance. So, at the very least, then, of course, there, Domodino will definitely talk about this more, but we don't. It's very harmful to trash other people, talk about their bad qualities. But more powerful is to unite them with your speech. Yeah? Okay, I'm going to just keep racing right through these. There's a lot we could say about that, but then I will tomorrow, no doubt. Okay, then instead of harsh speech, the corollary to that, of course, is speaking gently, with a caring, caringly, speaking kindly, tone of voice. Maybe we might even in this one, we might even include smiling. Oh, that's a great generosity out on the street doing errands. It's just to smile at people. You know, you smile at the person behind the counter that's working so hard for you. You smile at the guy in the Home Depot who's running around to get you faucet gaskets. You smile, you don't have time to stop, but you smile at the homeless person on the street. Acknowledge who they are, that they exist. Smile at the homeless person outside the Safeway. Very beautiful. I mean, it's not a speech, but it's communication. It's the opposite of harsh communication, isn't it? Relaxing people, making them feel safe and at ease with your tone of voice, with your word choice, and with your body language. Body language counts. Body language is a huge part of communication. You know, you could say something, you could say two entirely different things, and one of them you roll your eyes. And it means something completely different, doesn't it? Okay. And finally, for speech, there is the corollary to gossip, which is to speak about meaningful things, things that are beneficial. Things that are beneficial. I mean, we don't always have to talk about, you know, like heavy, profound, you know, life and death, Dharma speech only. It doesn't have to be like that. But it should be beneficial things. And that, like I said before, that can even be, you know, how about those Seahawks yesterday kind of thing. If it's got a benefit, if the benefit is healthy friendships, relationships with the people around you, but then obviously speaking when it's appropriate, in the right moment. And sometimes that might mean giving people enough space to run through their litany of whatever they're going to jabber about before they get to the thing that they really want to say to you that's really troubling them. Yeah? Being there to talk, and not just, here again, not just talking, but listening. I think maybe listening. We might say listening about meaningful things. That might even be the greater value here, because mostly people want to be, they don't so much want to hear you talk about meaningful things. They would rather have you listen to their, what's troubling them, what's on their mind, what's meaningful to them. Okay, 3 minutes, three of mind. Okay, so we've got, and actually these are pretty easy. We've got the easy to talk about, but trickier to do. So then the three negative actions of mind are to, you know, craving and coveting, and then mental states of harmful intent or hatred. That's the second. And the third is wrong view. And we, of course, here are talking about right view, aren't we? So we're full of creating good causes here by cultivating our wisdom. So the corollary to this first of craving is to rejoice in others' happiness and cultivate this loving kindness of wishing that the other be happy. Instead of the craving, may I get, how can I get, please may I get, I want mind. Which we do spend a lot of I want, I wish I had, I wish I had, I wish I could go there, I wish I could do this. I wish it's not all just about, like, I don't know, computer software or cars. It's about I wish I could go on this, I wish I could do this, I wish I could have that great experience, I wish I could, yeah? So rejoicing in others' happiness and generating this mind of, you know, may others have things that they wish they had. The second mental negative action is harmful intent or hatred. And the opposite to that is to generate a compassionate, a mind of compassion in which we wish that the other, that others do not suffer, that the other does not suffer. And finally, the opposite then of wrong view is to cultivate wisdom and a realistic view of life. So here you are for your entire week, spending your week generating all this positive karma, doing this positive action, and generating wisdom regarding non-harmfulness. Wow.
Just notice those last three, they correlate to the three poisons, right? Greed, hatred, delusion.
They do.
And then that's what drives all of them.
That is what drives all of them. You are so right.
That's a cool system.
And it is very cool. And, you know, they go heavier to lighter. Mm-hmm. So the mental attitudes are lighter in pact in terms of their negative results than say the acted out
karma.
The acted out actions. So, and of course it's easier, each one gets harder though. It's easier to get one's physical actions under control, like to keep yourself from slugging somebody in the nose when they insult you. Is that's one level of practice. To keep next, then speech, a lot more difficult. Not to give the person a piece of your mind. That's next level of difficulty. Most difficult, though, and last to, be tackled or to be successful in is the states of mind, of course. It takes a lot of repetition and a lot of interfering. Remember we said to get the foot in the door and to interfere with that craving thought or that angry, hateful thought. You might not be able to stop it, but to bring up the wisdom, understanding this is not a healthy state of mind. I do not like it. Can't stop it, but as soon as I can, I will. Yeah? then you've got your, that just every time you get your foot in the door and can say, this is not realistic, this is not going anywhere, this is a deluded state of mind. Every time you can bring that awareness to that train, to that emotional train that's roaring down the tracks, you bring that awareness to your train tracks. Every time you do that, you get a little bit more control. It's going to be a little bit weaker next time, a little bit weaker. And no need to go for absolutes. You don't need to like think, oh, I have to not have craving mind. Oh, I have not to have angry mind. No, you just have to notice it when it arises and say, this is negative. And then measure your results by reduced negative minds rather than the all or nothing, the failure if I'm angry. No. Could have been much more angry. Success. Note your successes.
What are the three poisons?
The three poisons. Anger, craving, and ignorance. And then, of course, they have a plethora of manifestations. But that's just the shorthand three. The big three, and then the categories. What are some examples of hatred, anger? Some other ones. Any others that fall into that category?
Ill will.
How about irritation? Impatience.
Frustration. It's all the kind of hot ones.
It's all the hot ones.
Right?
Okay. Let's dedicate. Let's think. May all of our positive actions, all of this positive karma that we've created in an effort to develop our wisdom, our understanding of the causes of happiness, the causes of safety, the causes of contentment, all of our effort to understand right view, may it flower in compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. May it flower in kindness for ourselves and kindness for others. Then may that compassion and kindness radiate out in our, from our lives, from each of our lives, benefiting everybody that we come in contact with. And radiating out in an endless circle of benefit, of compassion and kindness.